When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mario makes millions, the Zelda cops are coming for Discord, and a Halo vet has left Microsoft. This is VGC, a video game podcast with me, Jordan Midler, Chris Scullion, and Keza McDonald. How are we doing, folks? Welcome to the podcast, Keza.
Marvellous, good to see you both. I'm good. I'm surviving the Easter holidays, which is more than can be said for some parents of two small children at this point. So yeah, overall good.
What ages are we talking here? Are we talking really young? Because Chris has got quite a young one as well.
3 and 6. Jeez. In the trenches.
That's brutal.
I love this. Everyone's like, oh, you know, how brilliant it is having children. Like, congratulations on your lovely family. And you guys are like, fuck that. Like, that sounds terrible.
Well, is it the three-year-old must be at nursery at least.
Is yes. That? Yeah, mostly.
So that's, yes. Yeah, so it's really just a six-year-old. But
yeah.
Yeah, because mine is luckily still young enough for nursery. So this is my last non-school holiday situation, because you start school in the summer, after the summer, and then that's be fucked.
Yeah, you can look forward to 6 to 8 weeks of trying to figure out how to work around your children per year. It's going to be great.
Brilliant.
Just throw them in front of Roblox. That's what the kids are into these days. Just place them in front of Roblox for 6 weeks and that'll do.
Oh, don't get me started on Roblox.
How's things over in Edinburgh, Chris? You're currently, while El Capitan is flying about Japan at the minute, you're holding down the fort, so how's things going?
Yeah, not bad. Like, holding down is a strong word. I'm just basically got my foot on the fort so it doesn't blow away. I'm doing okay. I've seen before we started that I'm tired, but then when one of the guests is someone with two kids, I can't really say I'm tired. So without getting like shot in the face, so we'll just go with I'm doing okay for today.
Fair enough. Well, this week from an actual gameplay perspective, we've been talking about stuff that we've been playing, stuff that we can't quite talk about yet, but we still have info on EA's next big single player adventure. And since we have Keza and Chris, and I am a big old nerd for the old school games media days, I'm going to get some fun stories out of them. But first, the Mario movie is making a lot of money. Super Mario Brothers movie has smashed box office records for opening weekends of an animated film, beating Frozen 2. It's also flown right past the opening weekend for video game adaptations, which was Warcraft. It's made an absolute shit ton. Chris, have you seen it again yet?
I did. I went to see it again at IMAX, because when I went to see it on day one, like a big nerdy prick, it was the kid was in nursery, so it was just me and the missus. So I decided, because we wanted to kind of vet it first to see if it would be too scary for Serena. But the only other than the bit where kind of Dry Bones chases Luigi, I thought she'll be okay with this. So I kind of primed her for that bit, said, oh, there's a scary bit, but you'll be okay, won't you? And she's laughing. So, yeah, she loved it, absolutely loved it, which is good. She's singing the Peaches song constantly, which is quite annoying.
That is the TikTok hit of the summer, that Peaches song. It is absolutely everywhere.
But yeah, twice now. I think twice will do. I don't want to be one of these people who goes to see it 48 times and becomes insufferable. I'll just wait till the Blu-ray comes.
You don't need to see it that many times to be insufferable, pal. That's all good.
That's true.
What about you, Keza? Have you seen it? Has your clan seen it yet?
I've also seen it twice. Yeah.
Yes.
I went to see it with my older son, who's 6, last week, when on the day it came out. And, you know, it's fine. It was fine. Yeah. You know, my son loved it. And I was like, yeah, this is, you know, my expectations were so abyssal, so low, that I was actually quite pleased that it was not completely terrible. And then I went to see it again yesterday with my son again and one of his little friends, and the little friend did not like it at all. Like, every 10 minutes they were like, can we leave, when is it finished? So that was less enjoyable. And also, I have to say, on the second viewing, that film really doesn't stand up to scrutiny as an adult. Like, first time around you're like, okay, it's got the Mario stuff, here's the music, yay, let's this Rainbow Road. Second time around you're just like, this is just like a random sequence of events. Like, yeah. It really does suffer from a total absence of plot, but I enjoyed it anyway, you know.
Every time I talk to someone about it and I'm like, oh yeah, I saw the Mario film, and they're like, is it good? I'm like, no.
Not really.
But I did enjoy watching it. Yeah. And like every 5 minutes I turned to the person I was with and I was like, that's the GameCube noise. That's from this. That's from this. You see that?
I hope when your son's pal was moaning about being there, I hope you grabbed him and said, "Listen, don't you understand? That's a reference to Duck Hunt." Oh, no.
That's Chasseau Canard. Yeah,
can you tell?
You see, he was originally called Jumpman, and then they changed it. So that's what he's playing at the start there.
Oh yeah, I mean, I noticed the many references more second time around. First time around, I was like, well, it didn't labor the nostalgia too heavily. You know, it wasn't just a sequence of Mario stuff without context, really. It did, you know, it had some kind of internal logic. Second time around, I was noticing a lot more of the NES references and the other stuff that's in there. And I was being like, okay, it does actually labor the nostalgia quite heavily, to be fair. It does. Yeah. I genuinely was surprised by not hating it, put it that way.
Yeah,
put that on the fucking poster.
Absolutely. Didn't hate it. What a surprise.
Here's the question though, Keza. With all this money being made, does Universal just go absolutely crazy with the green light and green light 10 Nintendo films this year?
I don't want to say here's hoping. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would quite like to see what happens if they get another go at Mario. I mean, they will, clearly. Mm-hmm. Clearly there will be several more goes at Mario, right? So I'd quite like to see if maybe they'll be a little bit less safe and corporate with it next time, which could have an interesting result. Or could have a very bad one. I'm genuinely quite intrigued because I feel like the curse of the video game adaptation is lifted now, finally. I've endured like 3 decades of fascinatingly terrible video game adaptations. And so this is why my expectations are so low, I think, right? Because it's like, it can't be as bad as, for instance, the Monster Hunter movie from a few years back, which was just like, what is this? Who did anyone look at the game before? Did they just look at some concept? Did they look at an advert for the game and just make something up? So I would like to see more. I'd like to see how it goes. My expectations remain quite low, and I think that's the best way to keep it. Do you know what I mean? That's the best way to keep it. Like, how excited and how delighted were we all with Last of Us when it turned out to be actually good? And like, that's how I want to feel. When I see anything that's actually good, I want to be like, oh, brilliant. Look at that. It's not shite. So, yeah.
The thing you say about the corporatization, you imagine that Nintendo went with Universal and Illumination because they will do exactly what Nintendo wants.
Yeah.
And Nintendo's not going to do anything that's kind of out of step. I imagine the first non-Mario one, because it's their other big brand that isn't Pokemon. Pokemon's its own kind of thing, but you've got to imagine they start working on a Zelda thing pretty soon.
I want a like art house Kid Icarus movie about what it means to fly too close to the sun. I want like Joker but Kid Icarus. That's what I want to see. It would be very, very entertaining if that does happen. We just get all these random like C-tier Nintendo franchises of old being adapted by like small indie cinema makers. I think that would be brilliant.
Well, everybody's obviously kind of wanting to kick off another Marvel Cinematic Universe and hope that this is going to be the next thing. I don't see it myself, but it would be amazing. Like the equivalent of the Guardians of the Galaxy, which is something that nobody really expected before it came out to do well. It could be like a Clue Land movie. And then everyone's like, what the fuck? And then suddenly it becomes like the greatest Nintendo movie ever. I'm up for them doing it a lot, but I also worry about how successful some of them would be. Like Mario is the perfect storm because it's 3 generations or more of people know and love Mario, so adults go and see it, kids go and see it. If they release something like a Metroid movie, that's not going to do it anywhere near as well, and then you're going to just instantly get people saying, oh well, that's the wheels falling off, and it's like, well no, it's just, it's Metroid. It doesn't have that natural that massive fan base attached to it.
Speaking of Metroid, I've been mildly annoyed by the universal praise for how amazing Metroid Prime is since the remaster.
On you go.
It's amazing. Nobody was saying that at the time. It sold like 12 copies on the game. Like nobody ever for a second talked about Metroid Prime ever. Yeah. Like it was literally at the time, it was one of those things that about 3 people played and everybody who played it loved it, but it was not a kind of canon piece, kind of masterpiece in the Nintendo canon at all, or in gaming whatsoever. So the fact that it's come back out, everyone's like, oh yeah, Metroid Prime, wasn't that like an amazing sea change for the first person narratives? And I'm like, where were you in the 2000s or indeed at any point between now and then. That's that off my chest.
This is the video game equivalent. The video game equivalent of Kate Bush fans saying, yes. "Finally, after yes, Stranger Things."
It is exactly that. I mean, I was very amused by like the rave reviews everywhere and everyone being like, "Oh, so great to revisit this master." It's like, where did you buy it? I remember like I was talking to a guy who worked at Nintendo at the time, and like working at Nintendo during the GameCube days. Was like, okay, so when are we getting fired? When is the company going down? Mm. Like, you know, everybody working at, and they had like so little communication with Japan and that like basically they had no idea what was happening at any time. And then, you know, apparently the Wii came as a total surprise to everybody who was working at Nintendo outside of Japan. And then they all watched the same video that, you know, we watched from Tokyo Game Show at that time. And then they all sat down and went, right, okay, so where else should we look for a job? This is never going to work.
Jesus.
But yeah, the idea that Nintendo would keep extremely close control of any Mario or any Nintendo movie, I think that's what could ultimately kind of scupper it, if I'm totally honest, because Nintendo's not known for giving creative license to its partners generally. I think it's got better at that over the decades, but like it's not known for that. And I do think that if anybody wanted to do something genuinely a bit wild with any Nintendo property... That said, the 90s Mario movie did happen.
True. So that must have burned them so badly, though. Like, it took them 2 decades to come back and try it again.
It's another thing, though, right? There's so much retroactive absolution being offered to that Mario movie. Like, I'm seeing on Twitter, like, oh, actually, that one was better. And I'm like, oh,
yeah,
fuck
I saw,
off.
I saw that one. I won't name check the publication, but someone did say that the 93 Mario movie is actually better. I was like, go and take a fuck to yourself, because there's no chance whatsoever. Like, I went to that on day one with my dad. Me and my dad went to see the Mario movie in 93 when it first came out, and we were the only two people in the entire cinema on day one. And then so when I went with my wife to see Mario and the thing was packed on a Wednesday afternoon, I was like, this is finally going to do well. But my other worry is that everyone's now saying Zelda
no
movie.
Don't do a Zelda movie.
The problem is it's Nintendo and Illumination are like thick as thieves now. That doesn't work. They do comedy funny kids movies, and like somebody else would need to do Zelda. A Zelda movie. You would need to find another IP that is just as kind of lighthearted and jokey, which is why they're going to do a Mario sequel. They're probably going to do a Donkey Kong spin-off.
Zelda's also got like that. It's got that mystery element because it's never that clearly explained. You know what I mean? That like the plot of Zelda is always kind of in the background of things, and it's never that clearly explained. But you can go digging if you want to, and like the Hyrule Historia and all that connected a lot of stuff to. I'd never, you know, thought too hard about the Zelda lore until I read Hyrule Historia and was like, okay, so this all does actually connect together. Like, someone has thought about this, you know.
Yeah. It's not all just bollocks.
Exactly, right? Because, like, honestly, like, let's be honest, most video games from the 80s and 90s, like, it's just someone thought of a plot to put on the back of the box. Like, that is what video game plots were for so long, and that's why, obviously, they just basically have sucked when you try and adapt them. Yeah. And, yeah, you need something you can be playful with, don't you? Whereas it would be hard to be playful with Zelda. Yeah. I think you'd lose the mystery of the thing. Like, it's all about mood, isn't it, with adaptations? You got to get the mood of the thing from one form into another. And I think that's the easiest thing to mess up and the most crucial thing to get right. And that's actually, I thought the Mario movie did get that right. It got the mood, you know, just joyful, exuberant, like bouncy fun. You know, I really feel that it got the kind of the sound and the look, the joyfulness.
Yeah. It felt like being in that theme park, like when I very briefly stepped into the theme park, because it was like overwhelmingly full of people. You're just like, just this cacophony of noise that you're assaulted with on all sides. And that was very much what the film was like. Speaking of cacophonies of noise, Opening Night Live returns. Gamescom Opening Night Live will return this August, Jeff Keighley announced. In a tweet, the host and producer of the show has said that he's, quote, excited to be back in Cologne with the fans and industry streaming video game news directly to you. Opening Night Live is the Game Award producer's regular pre-show presentation for the German Gamescom Expo, which last took place in Cologne as an in-person event, which last year took place in Cologne, which was the first in-person one since 2019, because some stuff happened the year after. Are we expecting a big old Gamescom? Is it too close to Jeff Fest? Keza, I'll come to you first.
I'm hoping for a big Gamescom because we need something in our video game year now. Like, I am, you know, pretty devastated by the death of E3. At least for now, you know, pending confirmation, the death of E3 forever. Because we really need, I think, a focal point for the video games industry. Like, a lot of people have talked about how, oh, you know, it's too diffuse now. Basically, like, everybody makes their own announcements on their own channels. that's great for the fans of that particular thing. It's really bad for like the wider awareness of video games, actually. It's really bad for big news media brands, and it's really bad for anybody who's like likes games but doesn't spend, you know, hours and hours playing them every week, or who doesn't, you know, follow stuff on Twitter, who doesn't necessarily read specialist games news every day. So we need some kind of focal point event, and I'm kind of hoping that Gamescom might be able to step up and do it. However, the precedent isn't great. Like, Gamescom has never really managed to be... It's a consumer event, right? It's never managed to be that kind of nexus of news and industry. It's never gotten there. So, yeah, I mean, I think that these big showcases with tons of trailers, we've seen so many of them in the last few years. Like, something needs to happen. If Gamescom can be the thing that steps up to fill the void, that would be great. But I'm not sure it can.
Especially, I mean, this year they've said that a big partner who wasn't there at the 2019 one will return, so they're probably setting something up. Chris, what's your thoughts on Gamescom, other than us staying up all night covering it?
Oh, we'll need to stay up all night, because
another reason why Gamescom could please step up and fill the void.
Yes, I like Gamescom, but I think more because it's more manageable, because it is smaller. Like, I do agree that we need an E3, something of scale, something of magnitude, and as much as I like Gamescom, that isn't it yet, I don't think. Gamescom's the only one I've actually attended, because like, obviously when E3 comes, I'm the one who stays back and covers the news, and like, because I can write fast. I was like denied the ability to go to America, because like my I was better used in the office. But yeah, I went to Gamescom once, which was actually the first time I met Keza, actually, when it used to be in Leipzig, which was fun.
You remember when Gamescom was in Leipzig, and Leipzig is a very fun and weird city. I'm a big Germany fan over here, so like, I've been to a lot of the German cities. Leipzig is like super, super weird. And Gamescom was the biggest thing that happened in Leipzig all year, you know, and it was like a huge deal for the city. I don't feel like it's like that in Cologne. Like, Cologne has a lot of these conferences and stuff, but I've been to Gamescom pretty much every year for 17 years, which is ridiculous, obviously. But like, the last time I was there, last summer, I started having like a strange out of body experience, because I was wandering the kind of Cologne conference hall thinking, is this me? Is my ghost going to be wandering the Cologne Convention Center for the next 100,000 years? It's just going to be like me looking for the Microsoft booth for the rest of my natural life. I had a real moment of like, what am I doing with my life? And I think that the kind of setting of it isn't as like bombastic as E3, right? It's not the kind of like, and I think it's partly because it's not American. It's not got the kind of, it's not got everybody getting together in big halls and all the whooping and all that stuff that made E3 quite fun to watch. Gamescom doesn't have that. It's not fun to watch, I don't think.
Yeah. Kez, I don't know if you remember this, because you've interviewed 12 million people probably over the years. Do you remember Gamescom, and the year I went would have been 2007, 2008-ish, and me and you both had to do a joint interview with, I think it was Igarashi, the Castlevania guy, and it was basically, because there was so many people wanting to interview him, they basically teamed journalists up and basically said, you both get this interview. So it was me and you in a room with him, and he had an enormous whip and just sat it on the table.
Still had his
hat on, and it was just like a really odd, and the only question I remember saying to him, because I was still quite new and just asking the shit questions, and I was like, what's your favorite Castlevania game? And I remember him saying something like, oh, that would be like asking me to choose my favorite child, but probably Symphony of the Night.
I do remember the threatening aura of that interview in general, actually. This is it. Like, also, this was, you know, because it was a while ago, the interviews weren't so closely managed. So, like, at one point at Gamescom, maybe the same year or like, you know, around then, I got put in a room with Hideo Kojima, who was incredibly fed up, clearly. Just absolutely no time for any of this. And I was told to ask, like, is Metal Gear Solid, whichever one it was at the time, coming to Xbox? And he just went on this massive rant, like, for fuck's sake, everybody just asks me what fucking console the stupid game's coming out, and does nobody care about my art? He went on this, like, massive rant. And, like, I speak Japanese, so I was listening, and like, oh, he's really, really mad. He's seriously mad. And then the translator was like, we have nothing to announce at this time.
I was talking to a peer of ours who remained nameless, so we can continue this amazing technique, but he also speaks Japanese, and he'll be doing an interview with a Japanese dev, and they'll mistranslate what the answer is.
Yep, they do.
And he has multiple times stopped them and went, "That's not what they said. Translate it properly." And I just think that's the most fucking baller move ever.
They're missing a trick there, because what you do is remain completely quiet, so that they don't know you speak Japanese, and then later you can go back over it. Maybe get a pal who speaks better Japanese than you to listen to it as well, and do it properly.
Yeah.
Well, I really hope Gamescom happens, because I have booked what is probably the sketchiest hotel in Cologne. I've got a
long experience of sketchy hotels in Cologne at this point, mate. Like 15 years worth.
It looks like there's like two hospital beds like placed together.
Wow.
But the breakfast looks nice, so that's really all you're asking for when you're traipsing through a big convention center.
I went like to that. The weirdest Gamescom I had was the year I was pregnant. And I went, and I'm like, I was massive. And I was like waddling the halls. And like, nobody had any idea how to deal with a pregnant games journalist. I don't think it had ever happened. I genuinely think nobody had ever encountered this problem before. And it was the year that they were doing, you know, that Resi demo, the Resi demo, was it the kitchen demo? The one where you get beheaded in it and everything in VR. So I turned up at Capcom, and they took a look at me, took a look at the, and they were like, we don't think you should play this. I was like, okay, can I watch someone else play it? They were like, we think that's best. So I watched some poor Capcom guy like do the demo, and I was just watching the screen while they were in VR. And I was like, well, I really feel like I've experienced this as much as I want to. At this point, I just loved the idea of them like freaking out the pregnant games journalist so much that like I went into labor on the show floor. Would have been quite a story.
That would have been great PR though if that had happened.
That's like a mid 2000s
thing. Not so much for you.
For some Resident Evil game or some horror game, they had like body parts around London and then lost some of them. Weeks later, they were like, if anyone comes across like a plastic arm, could you return it?
Was that the year they did the butcher shop and they made like human? Yeah, because yeah, but so it was all made of meat, so it would have been slowly deteriorating. Oh my god!
Yeah.
No,
some guy's like taking the bins out at his work, and there's just an arm like slowly melting to dust. Like, oh god,
that's not as bad as the God of War party though, is it?
Where they killed the goat?
Yeah,
that was infamous, wasn't it? I was not there. I wasn't there.
Your Honor, I was not
there. No, I just want to say.
I wasn't there, but I hear a lot of magazines had to be pulped. Official PlayStation covered it. A magazine covered it in great detail with detailed images, and then had to pull the every issue and reprint it. That was grim.
Turns out it's not in the greatest taste to live slaughter a goat at a promotional marketing event for a video game.
Nah. Better days, if you ask me. This is the games industry that when I was like a kid, I was reading about it, and I was like, this is going to be fucking quality. And now I get into it, and it's like flights to like nice wee hotels, go play the game, flights home. It's none of this debauchery. It's not flying to Cabo.
I feel like Chris and I got in right at the end of the wild era of when magazines were selling hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, because we'll have both heard stories from before our time that were just outlandish, and like we had some pretty outlandish. I remember they don't do these awards anymore, but I'll probably not name check them just in case someone's involved. But there was a regular media award for the game.
What could you possibly be talking about?
I've got about like, nine of them on my shelf back there.
well, some of us weren't so lucky. And it had like one of them was at like a burlesque bar, and then one of them was at like a normal venue, but then like they had that sponsorship with a certain independent games retailer which ended up with like condoms in the tables and stuff like that. That was like the glory days.
God, it was so pathetic. That was the thing. Like, it was so sad. You know, it's like, oh man. Like, I remember hearing stories about like the Tomb Raider 2 preview where I think they flew everybody to Egypt for like a week and a half, and everybody had magazine deadlines, right? So it's not like now where you have to write everything up like the second it happens. It has to be on the internet like in moments. It was literally like they would see the game for 3 hours and then spend 5 days in Egypt and then like have to write 300 words on it when they get back. I'm like, Jesus, that is a very different job from the one that I've been doing all this time.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's this infamous person who used to cover games for one of the tabloids. Who used to just turn up to every single thing, all these trips, and then like 100 word column once a week. That was how it was. Yeah. What a cushy job. Yeah.
crazy days. Sorry, Jordan, we're massively derailing your news.
Oh no,
with our stories, with our...
It's what old people do, Jordan. We reminisce. You can't really. You just have to like sit there and go, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just let us do. I it.
Mean, do you remember Space Hoppers?
Space World?
Former guest of this show, Jeff Gerstmann, literally has a Patreon podcast where it's him and Glenn Rubenstein, who have been covering games since 1992, just talking about what it was like to cover games right at the start of like Sega and Nintendo and stuff like that. So it's an they're like 3 hours long, and I sat and listened to them like, yeah, I understand this. I wasn't born, but I understand back in those days.
Ah, the old days.
Yeah, classic. Which I wasn't there times.
For. Yeah, I mean, I hear better stories from the 90s. I think the 90s was just a wild decade, TBH.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was once taken out to lunch by a PR who came up to Glasgow, and they formerly wrote for a bit of a Wild West magazine back in the day. And he was just like, yeah, on a deadline, the editor would just occasionally come around and give us eckies. I was like, yes, that is the industry.
Old school.
My favourite old school story, and you must have been told, Andy must have told you this one at some point, Jordan, was at the E3 when they announced the DS, so maybe 2004 or something like that, and... I'll not name the person, but the then official Nintendo magazine before Future took over, the whole team went to E3 to cover it, and they get sent into this kind of like a secret kind of for VIP press where they had loads of DSs all set up, and all they had was PictoChat. And the whole point was like, I know that, and you know what's coming. And the whole point was to like, they were all linked up so you could pick to chat with other people. And they had big, massive screens up, like show, which they didn't realize, right? And this chap in particular did what everyone would do and drew an enormous dick. And like, as I understand it, because this is before my time, it was very detailed. even by PictoChat standards, and then apparently he was informed by a member of Nintendo staff that this massive penis was on display on this giant screen, and that these screens were being shown to people standing in the queue, like waiting to get in, like to the main kind of consumer bit, and apparently turned around and saw Miyamoto just shaking his head disappointed.
You have disappointed the father of video games.
If you disappoint Miyamoto, you're like,
wow.
Oh, no.
I'd never get over that. I'd just lie down on the ground and never get up again.
Be the end.
Anyway.
Sorry, John.
There's no vault fast to this next story. Halo veteran Joseph Staten is leaving Microsoft. He announced on Twitter his departure will mark the end of his second 9-year spell at the company. He's been working on Halo for around 2 decades. Quote, hey folks, I'm indeed leaving Microsoft, Staten said after the news broke. I'll have more info soon, but for now, I'd like to thank Xbox and all those lads. That last bit was paraphrasing. Here's my question. Obviously, Staten was parachuted in to try and save Infinite, which, depending on how you feel about Infinite, was either successful or extremely unsuccessful. What the hell's going on with Halo in 2023, Keza?
I think it might be done for a while, if I'm totally honest. I feel like Infinite really bore the hallmarks of a game that couldn't be made it couldn't be realized as envisioned, right?
Yeah.
Like, when I played that, I was like, this is interesting. This is a game that's very different from the one that they wanted to make. Like, you could see, like, the shape of the game that existed was you could see the outline of what it was supposed to be. And clearly it just, for whatever reason, couldn't happen. And so I do wonder if it needs a break. I think Halo might need a kind of big break, actually.
Yeah.
Because also was it Paramount that did the series?
Oh, yeah. Mm. That went well.
Yeah. So I'm a bit like, I think like maybe it just needs just some time to chill and to have a refresh in a few years. That would be my major feeling on it at the moment. I don't think a Halo game has really excited me for really quite some time. And now when I hear there's a new Halo thing in development, I feel sorry for the people who are making it, because it's like it must be relentless, you know.
It's strange because, like, to me, Halo feels very mid-2000s. It feels like 2005 to 2012. That is like Halo, and it almost feels like the nostalgia cycle, which is currently in kind of like the early Y2K era in terms of like fashion and music, feels like it has to come back up to the late 2010s, and then people will be like, oh, remember Halo, like things like that. Needs to go away long enough for people to be like, remember Halo.
That is a very astute observation, and it's funny how this is very predictable. Like, the stuff that, so basically the stuff that we were into, I'm pointing at Chris, the stuff that we were into when we were like teenagers is now all back. And when that happens to you the first time, you're like, oh God, I hate this. And then you realize that you're basically just being, you know, you're being catered to, you're being pandered to by everybody who owns all of the entertainment and fashion and everything else properties that you liked when you were a teen. They're like, come have some more of that. We're just going to nakedly exploit your brain chemistry to make you nostalgic for this. But then it happens again in 10 years. Like it happens every 10 years. And so this is what I'm thinking about Halo. Like it needs to wait until the current teenagers who have fond memories of playing Halo 2 and 3, it needs to wait until they're approaching 30.
So this is the thing, like I am that demographic, and like it's, you can start to see it happening. Obviously HBO Max yesterday were like, we're bringing back Harry Potter, and obviously that was trying to be like remember that thing from your youth, whereas everyone who's my age was a bit like, no, you've kind of fucked that up. Yeah, so Halo is like, it's like, that's actually a bit of our youth that we used to love that has been quite tainted, actually. So how about you don't bring that one back? So Halo is like that comes out in 2007. I'm like 12, 13 or whatever. And that was that Gears of War.
Which Halo would that have been again? Three.
Halo 3. Yeah. So that. I was just going into high school, so that was like the.
We used to sit at work and let the Halo 3 music play in the background. The title screen music.
I was going to double modern studies and then home ec and then talking about like our Slayer matches.
The first non Nintendo console, I think, that I bought was the Xbox, the OG Xbox. And we had, like, when I was about 14, I would get my friends to literally lug televisions and Xboxes around my house so that we could play 16 player Halo 1 with no internet. Nice. This was pre console internet. And like those were good parties. I have to say they were probably not the parties that you hope to be invited to when you're 14, but we had a good time nonetheless playing our 16 player LAN Halo. But I have such fond memories of that era of Halo. But it's kind of been demolished by just years of, I really feel like it's a production line, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it isn't helped by the fact that Microsoft have had to, like, absolutely hang out the back of it as its, like, main brand, as everything else is. Like, you can't hang the Xbox on Forza, even though those games are amazing. Mm. No one's like, who's your favorite Xbox character? A car.
Yeah.
Like, they have been looking for their... And Master Chief was that thing for ages. Mm. And, like, that and Gears of War, it's all very... It's all very Korn, all very Linkin Park. That
Isn't
just
it?
Has to
Yeah, I feel
come
like it's just
again.
Not in fashion at the moment. Like the kind of grim, dark Gears of War and the kind of operatic sci-fi, like gruff men saving the universe. It's just out of fashion right now. I think that's really true.
It looks like what mid-90s old stuff looked like to me when I was like 12, 13. So it has to like... It has to cycle out. And if you get rid of Halo for a while, that's a free big pop in like a couple of years. You play the music, everyone goes fucking spare. You announce a remake of 3, all that shit.
So. I think it's interesting because like Destiny has kind of replaced what Halo used to be, I think, in the kind of cultural consciousness of like teen and early 20s gamers now. Like they all love Destiny. And they, you know, people started playing Destiny as kind of young teenagers and still play, but it's that kind of the vibe of Destiny is so close to the vibe of Halo, I think. Like it's so close to it, but it's better than any Halo game that's been made in a really long time. So I think like that may be another aspect. I think Destiny may have stolen Halo's thunder in the intervening years.
And there also just needs to be kind of a recontextualization of what a Halo game is in the kind of Destiny era, because obviously 3 was a huge step for like widening the appeal of these mainstream kind of competitive multiplayer games. Obviously they had it in 2 and stuff like that, but the 1-2 punch of like Gears of War and Halo 3's online with Xbox Live, everyone getting a headset, everyone shouting abuse at each other, that was like the thing. But you go back and play Halo 3 now, mechanically it's still fantastic, but it feels very basic, and the current suite of Halo multiplayer options doesn't feel like there has been almost 15 years since that one. They haven't kind of redefined it in a way.
I do feel like there was one major advantage with Halo's multiplayer, which is that it's nice and slow for the old people. Those of us...
I feel like I'm running in mud when I'm playing Halo. I want Warzone. I want to be like sliding at 100 miles an hour and spinning around.
I can't
like,
handle that shit, that. Jordan. I can't. Yeah. I can't keep up with it. Honestly, like I cut my teeth on online multiplayer and like, you know, first person shooter multiplayer in the early 2000s when things were that slow. And like I just never have managed to up my Like I can't keep up with Call of Duty now. You know, I can play it and I enjoy it, but I can't, you know, I'm not competitive and I never will be. But the nice thing about Halo is that it was, Halo Infinite's multiplayer was so lovely because it was just like nice and slow and very like, it still had the kind of, you have to know the maps, you have to know where the weapons are on the maps. It wasn't so much about loadouts as it was about knowing the game, and it felt more strategic. Yeah. And I actually really did appreciate that, I have to say. I was like, this is fun. This is fun. I'm enjoying myself playing a multiplayer shooter for the first time in ages.
Chris, I will bring you in on Xbox's weird vibes in a moment, but I'm just going to add this for context. Redfall, I have it here in the running order, in my running order, Redfall more like Shitfall, don't quote me on that. Redfall is launching on Xbox consoles do with better, a quality mode.
Fanboy shit. You're really not helping, you're really like not helping the Twitter narrative that VGC hates Xbox. You're really not helping that at all with fucking Redfall more like Shitfall.
Yeah, but you just said that, you quoted that, that you've just said
I'm
that, Chris.
You.
Pete, take yeah, what weapon. I said it and get it out of the podcast and just leave Chris's bit. Redfall is launching on Xbox consoles with quality mode only. On Series X, it'll be 4K 30. On Series S, it'll be 1440 30. A 60 FPS performance mode will be added later via an update. You would have thought they dropped nukes on Faz Lane the way that people reacted to this yesterday. People seem to forget that Arkane make fantastic games, and this game will probably still be pretty good. Chris, what were your feelings on this earth-shattering news?
Couldn't give a fuck, mate.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, like, we're old enough to, you know, again, that obviously the theme of this podcast is old pricks. And we're old enough to remember GoldenEye and stuff like that. It's like, yes, it's lovely to have a first-person game that runs at 60 frames per second. Hell, give me 120 frames per second, I don't care. But 30 frames per second doesn't kill a game dead. It's no. Like, yeah, you'd prefer 60, but I don't care. And frame rate's given far too much clout. A lot of people, like, I'm sick of people saying if a game doesn't run at 60, it makes them physically ill to play, or it's physically it's literally unplayable and shit.
That's
like that.
Fair, but I think frame rate in a first-person game actually does matter.
Definitely helps, absolutely helps, and I would prefer 60 to 30, but that doesn't mean 30 is a non-starter for me. I'll still play it. Do you know what I mean? I just don't. It's disappointing, but it's not. It's not a deal breaker for me. I don't care that much.
That's the thing. Like, obviously, I actually don't know if I'm reviewing it. Whatever that shakes out. If I don't end up reviewing it, this just becomes something that I will play when the 60 patch is out because it's on Game Pass. I think people were going absolutely wild about this yesterday, and I don't really understand it. And it was mostly from kind of the Xbox's core base being like, "Come on, lads, this is like you're advertising this as like the world's most powerful console, and you can't get your big first party game out at 60 at 4K, and then they compare like, oh, the PlayStation stuff when Spider-Man and God of War come out with 50 different graphical options and all that stuff. And I think that's apples and oranges, not the best comparison, but people get pissed off about it. And it makes me wonder, Jason Schreier made a good point about how between this, the stuff about how if you play Redfall in co-op, only the host gets the progression, none of the other people do, and how the gameplay hasn't looked great. It was like, it's almost as if Bethesda wants it to fail. And I feel like that's a shame, because it's, at the end of the day, it's an Arkane game. And Arkane, there's a bit of a meme about how much games journalists love Arkane games, but I'm still excited about it. Keza, what's your vibe on Redfall?
To me, it has the vibe of a game that someone went, we need to service game this. We need to make this, you know, cause you can always see when, so something that's, I think, unique, well, not completely unique, but certainly much stronger in games than other media, is that the business model of the game determines the experience a lot. Like, the actual design of a game changes depending on whether you're doing, this is multiplayer, this is multiplayer designed to last for years, this is service, this is microtransactions, this is free to play, or this is you pay £40 and you get 10 hours. Like, that the business model and the way that you're intending to engage players completely changes creatively everything that you're kind of aiming for with the game, right? And I've seen over the years now many, many times where a studio has clearly been given a business model and had to make a game fit that, right?
Yeah.
And the biggest and saddest example of this is Fable with Lionhead. They were told
RIP.
Well, seriously, I mean, who, well, you know, 2010's Xbox, that's who, 2010's Microsoft Things are much better now, but certainly at that point, you know, who would say to that studio, to Lionhead, make an asymmetric multiplayer game? They're never going to be able to. And then they bring in US, you know, game dev executives from Riot and from other places like that who can make that kind of game. And they bring them into a completely different studio with a completely different culture and go, okay, now do it. Now do the service game. Anyway, so that can really stymie a game. And I feel like something about Redfall strikes me as perhaps maybe it wasn't originally going to be the kind of multiplayer centric for, you know, I think that maybe there might have been a different idea for that game at the start. And for whatever reason, they're working in a zone that they're not comfortable with, right? Yeah. As developers. Yeah. And despite all of the resources available to them from Bethesda and Microsoft, obviously two of the biggest companies, biggest one company now in the world, sometimes you can't just make an entirely new type of game as a studio on that. Like, it's hard to do, right? It's hard to transition. So I feel like that's the vibe I'm getting from it. And I really want to play it, though. I'm excited for it, genuinely.
Yeah.
Partly because I'm one of those annoying games journalists who loves Arcane. But I am looking
at it
and thinking...
Talk about Deathloop for a million years and it sells two copies.
I still think it will do well at the end of the day. Like, Game Pass aside, I mean, critically, from what I can gather by the hands-on previews that went out recently, everyone was up for it. Everyone... Or pretty much most of the previews I read were like really up on it and saying that this is actually really good, this is going to be good. And that was just a single player, I believe. Mm. But so I think over time, maybe when the 60 FPS patch comes and whatever, and I think over time it will go down as like a good game. But it does feel like Arcane are kind of running up a hill a bit.
I feel like with things. Yeah, I feel they're out of their comfort zone here.
Yeah.
Clearly. I mean, the fact that we've got these technical limitations shows me that something's gone a bit wrong somewhere, right? Like, that shouldn't be. I'm not a performance oriented person at all, but as Jordan was saying, this is Microsoft is caters to performance oriented gamers. Like, Xbox is the console for performance oriented gamers, and the fact that they can't get one of their flagship games to run beautifully does suggest to me that something's gone awry, you know?
Yeah. I also, it feels like if there hadn't developed this kind of meme about Xbox games not coming out, that they maybe pushed us back a bit. Especially when it's coming out, it comes out 4 days after Jedi and like a week before Zelda. Like,
that's sending it out to die, isn't it?
Like, that's even in the service model where it will be there forever. Bump it to like the end of June, where fuck all is coming out, and then it's like, here's this big thing. You can be the conversation over the summer, even though people still be playing fucking Zelda. But
you're almost never going to be the conversation under those circumstances. Like, it really does feel like it's being sort of maybe shoved out at a point where no one will pay attention to it, almost on purpose, as alluded to. It seems like a strange decision to me.
Yeah,
I mean, if it turns out that it's a pure shiter, like, it would make more sense. But when it comes from Arcane, it's fucking Harvey Smith. Like, you look at that guy's like discography. You look at his gameography, or whatever the correct term is.
Softography.
You look at that, and it's just banging after banger. So I'm still very excited for it.
I've just realized how stupid a term softography is. it sounds like something you'd find on Channel 351 when you're on holiday.
Just for 5 minutes, though.
Scrambled.
Allegedly.
Speaking of crimes, the Nintendo cops are coming after Discord after a Tears of the Kingdom art book was leaked. Nintendo's lawyers have basically said to Discord, give me the identification of Julian #2743, which will be written in the history books and legal textbooks forevermore.
At least it's not like, you know, Elite Gamer 457.
See, that'd be better. Big Papa Pump 69. Yeah. Like, more like that. Like, that's more my style. I don't really care about this specific case. I hope Julian rots in hell for his crimes against Nintendo.
Strong words, Jordan.
I am more interested. What is the biggest gaming leak you can remember? I'll start. I mean, let's not count the GTA 6 one, because when that happened, it was like a calm Sunday morning. I sit down at my desk. I'll knock out a few stories, and then it's just like the end of the world that happens. Chris, biggest leak you can remember?
I mean, from a nerdy point of view, it has to be that Nintendo leak from a few years ago.
Yeah.
When basically, because Nintendo obviously been one of the most secretive companies, especially from its 8-bit and 16-bit days, for suddenly a load of old prototypes to suddenly come out. and like prototypes of Yoshi's Island with like different protagonists and like proper high res N64 like era artwork and stuff. Like, as for a nerd like me, that's gold dust. And for it to have kept kind of trickling out over time as well was just like unbelievable. And I get the feeling that there's maybe still more there that we haven't seen yet, because they promised 10 times more than has actually come out. And I wonder if over time we'll start to see even more of it, because Nintendo for me is still this company of mystery and magic, and it's of all the companies that you want to see the creation process. I mean, you got Atari 50 came out like at the end of last year and was a brilliant way of showing how like the history of a company and how their behind the scenes development went and all that kind of stuff. And lots of Atari developers have no problem whatsoever sharing in great detail all the thought process and all the games they've made, whereas Nintendo is the complete opposite. So anything
black box
ever leaks, exactly. So anything that ever leaks from Nintendo, to me is instantly the most interesting leak.
Hmm. Keza, do you remember any bangers?
So I ran Kotaku in the UK for many years, and there was a point where every single year we leaked Assassin's Creed, or rather someone leaked Assassin's Creed to us, and we would then publish that information. Literally every, to the point where it actually got quite harsh. After about 4 years of it, it got to the point where it was like, oh, here's the big Assassin's Creed leak again. Yay! And it's starting to feel a bit harsh. But it was also quite funny because Ubisoft were so angry about it. And like, ultimately, what is this? It's you know, when something, a leak on that kind of level is essentially someone's marketing plan getting messed up.
Yeah.
It's like, no harm is done, in my opinion, no harm is done by that kind of leak. Like, it's something that we were all going to know in a month or two. We just know it a little bit earlier, you know?
Yeah. Mm.
But yeah, after the continual series of Assassin's Creed leaks, I mean, it did get to the point where it kind of caused Kotaku to revisit its policy, our editorial policy on like, do we publish this stuff anymore? Because it did get to the point where is this news? You know, what we're doing is showing people something that they're going to see anyway in a few months. Yeah. And it led to a kind of broader conversation about like the press's role in leaks, actually, which I thought was really interesting. And you don't see it so much now, you know?
Yeah.
And interestingly, actually, Red Dead Redemption 2, there was a very minor leak from there of basically concept art and stuff like that. And all of everyone got sent it, right? Like, where was I working? So I think I was at Kotaku, maybe The Guardian, I can't remember, but we got leaked it. And you look at that and you're like, okay, someone's stolen that. Like, that's just something that someone has stolen. They've managed to get, like the GTA 6 leak, right? They've managed to get into Rockstar's server somewhere and they've just stolen that and sent it out to whoever. You don't touch that with a barge pole. Like, that is not...
Especially Rockstar.
Exactly. One outlet did touch it.
Yep.
And ended up paying many, many millions of pounds in not reparations, that's not the right word, help. What's the, what is it? Damages.
Reparations.
Not reparations, damages. to Rockstar. And, you know, they're lucky that that publication happened to have like a very, very big corporation behind it, or they would have been like, that would have taken down a lot of us, you know? And yeah, like, so it's really interesting when you look at when things leak, I'm always thinking, oh, who's getting legaled for that? You know?
Yeah.
But then I really think that what Chris pointed out, when you get leaks that are like old data, interesting old data about games that have been out in the, you know, for decades or whatever, like those are I genuinely think those are societally useful. You know, none of us are Edward Snowden here, let's be honest. So like, but that is as useful as video game leaks get. And I really love when that happens, when we get, you know, some data miner or someone gets in there and finds like prototypes of games that we know and love, that we see kind of the process. I think that that's something that gets lost because games are so commercialized as art products. It gets lost, like the process of making something is often just secret forever, which I think is a big shame.
Mm. Yeah. Mine is, there's like beta versions of Pokemon Gold and Silver from, I think it was like a Space World or whatever that show was, the one that was in Shishinkai. They had like a demo version of Gold and Silver that had totally different sprites and a load of different Pokemon that never appeared, and that eventually got out and people have been like pasting that together. So that's good fun. Obviously a few years ago, the Walmart Canada thing that completely spoiled all of E3, that was great fun to be on Twitter and just see Wario64 be like, don't bother staying up watching this, here's every single game. But yeah, it's the Tears of the Kingdom thing, it's I mean, there's a trailer, there's another trailer or something coming this week, but they've got such, they're such fucking Billy Big Bollocks about this game. They've showed fuck all about it, and they're just like, it's a sequel to Breath of the Wild, mate. It's probably going to get 105 on Metacritic. We're just going to put it out and it'll be fine.
To be fair, I was like, I was a bit worried about that. I was like, why are they not showing anything? Is this going to be more of the same? Not that I complain about more of the same if it's Breath of the Wild. Yeah. But then when they showed that gameplay footage a few weeks ago, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. This is amazing. Yeah. This is incredible. Like, how, you know, the idea that they'd like kept it very, very secret, but they had this killer idea that they were just like casually dropping a couple of months before it comes out. Like, we would all have been hyped for much longer had this, you know, had we known what the actual game was even a bit earlier. But that's Nintendo for you. You can't ever predict. Yeah. You never can predict.
That's what Nintendo do to you. Speaking of games that haven't been shown much, after the break, we have some news on EA's Immortals of Avium.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
All of Avium is crumbling apart.
You don't win in Everfall.
You help us win this. I'll know you're ready.
So last week I got the chance to check out Immortals of Avium, which you may remember from the Game Awards. This is EA's big first person magic game from the creative director of Dead Space, Brett Robbins. More excitingly for me, he was the lead designer on that EA Return of the King game, if you remember that. That was, I don't know if that was just a banger because I was like 10 or whatever, and I thought that game was fantastic. I know I'll probably look up magazines and it's like, oh, churlish, a licensed game, 3 out of 10. But the exciting thing about this game, which to put it in your mind, it's like a first person shooter, but it's magic. Imagine like Doctor Strange hands, so you're doing circles, you're shooting bolts and things like this. And this makes sense because Brett Robbins also worked on Call of Duty campaigns, so it's magical Call of Duty, which as soon as they started saying that, I was like, okay.
I was gonna say it sounds like Hexen, but then I realized you'd probably be minus years old when Hexen came out, so never mind.
It's for a contemporary reference for people that aren't in fucking nursing homes, it's like
Doctor Strange
or Ghostwire Tokyo, that kind of like
I can think of so many old games that have that. And I'm not going to say any of them. It's just going to show me up. You shoot magic from your hands.
Yeah. Been there, mate.
Is it like Bioshock? Like that?
I mean,
like that kind of magic from the hands?
It is that kind of magic for the hands, but it's less like, oh, here's a hand that's on fire, let's shoot like a little ball of fire. It's very choreographed dancing. I'm for people watch, I'll put this video footage online. I'm currently just gesturing my hands as if I'm like bringing a plane into
your
land.
Is what's happening.
Exactly. So it's a lot of that, and Brett Robbins, the creative director, was like, I was making a Call of Duty campaign and the characters had to run up this side street, and I just sat there and thought to myself, what if a dragon was came down and attacked these guys? And then he was like, well, I have to go and make this game. So they've been making it for years. It's like a full-on big budget AAA Unreal Engine 5 EA single player game. They've barely talked about it and it's out in July.
I have to be like, honest, I had not heard about it before this moment.
Yeah, they announced it at the Game Awards with like a nice trailer, and I think because it was in the Game Awards and there was fucking 50 billion games,
that's
before
thing,
we're like, yeah. Oh yeah, okay.
Also, so, it was like 6 a.m. for us by this point.
I mean, Christopher Judge had been talking for 3 hours at that point. You're like, gee, come on, mate.
It's actually still on. We've just taken a break to do this.
So I asked them about that as well. I was like, this is like a huge game. Like, why aren't you doing the usual marketing cycle? And it was like, I think this is an interesting point. There's so many games now. There's so many TV shows, there's so many films. We announce this game with all this information. By the time it comes out, you've completely forgotten about all of it, and we essentially have to do it again, the whole thing. Whereas now, it's April, and it comes out in July. So that is a time where you can be like, oh, I can get excited about this because I'll be playing it pretty soon. Kind of like what they did for Fallout 4 or whatever, when they announced that and released that later in the year. But yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic about it. My only problem is magic in games doesn't feel as good as shooting a gun, because when you shoot a gun, it feels kind of heavy and weighty, and your controller rumbles. Whereas you do magic, it's just semaphore, it's things like this. So they tried to accommodate that. They were like, how do we make the magic equivalent of a shotgun? How do we make a magic sniper rifle? How do we make this feel the way you feel in a COD campaign, but magic? So yeah, it's interesting, and obviously the pedigree, fucking creative director of Dead Space, so I'm excited about it. Chris, what do you think about this idea of announcing something this big from a company like EA, or reveal, it's already announced. I keep saying, when I talk to people about this game, I keep saying, oh, it's being announced, because fucking no one remembers the Game Awards.
Yeah, basically, but yeah.
The grand unveiling in April, and it comes out in July, what do you think about that?
It's interesting. I mean, I get it. I'm on board with it. They did it before with Wild Hearts, where they kind of announced it, and then it basically came out like a few months
later. Was that
an
EA original? Was that under that label as well? Because this is one of their EA originals.
Yeah, I think so, but it was them and Koei Tecmo, wasn't it? But I think it was under EA originals. So it sounds like this is their kind of strategy going forward, certainly for certain types of game, and maybe like the more... I'm fine. I'm all for it. I'm a very impatient person. So what I don't know doesn't hurt me, basically, in terms of waiting for stuff. So nothing excites me more than during a conference when someone says, and it's out now, and I go, okay, well, I don't have to wait for it. These kind of secret drops where it's just like, oh, here's the game, and I go, oh, that'd be brilliant, oh, I can get it now, okay, that's fine. So the closer to launch that something gets announced, the happier I am. I mean, it's probably not good for me to say, considering my job partly involves writing about these things and needing to know about these things long in advance so we've got content.
But as soon as when fucking Hi-Fi Rush got announced, and it's like, okay, Andy, there'll be a review in 2 days, I'm going to go not sleep for 48 hours and get this finished.
That's the distinction, isn't it? Like, personally, love it when a game gets surprised announced. Professionally, it's like, oh, come on. I'm never going to be able to cover this now, you know.
Give us a week, like, exactly. Announce it that it's coming out next week, like, be sound.
Yeah,
and I think can you still get buzzing about long away release dates? Like at the Jeff Fest this year, when shit comes up and says 2024, do you still get buzzing, or is it like it'll come in when it comes in for you?
I feel like I've adopted a mindfulness approach to this, where it's like what's happening in the moment is what I'm paying attention to, right? Because there is so much noise now, not just from games but from everything. And there's so much to keep on top of. And I struggle to keep on top of it, right? Like, I have spreadsheets full of, you know, interesting looking games of all kind of sizes from all kinds of developers. And it would probably be a part-time job just to keep those spreadsheets updated. You know what I mean? So I feel like I think there's a balance to be struck. I like it when something is announced and then not shown until maybe a couple months, few months. I think 6 months is for me the maximum.
Yeah.
Really. To actually show something properly, you can say it's in the works, but like if you're, I mean, these days it's not like it used to be. There's now so much content and everything's available all the time, immediately now, right? It's, you know, streaming and games and everything else. Everything's very sudden and it all happens. There's so much available to us all at any one time that I think managing the hype cycle, as it were, has really changed. I do struggle when something like this will come out sometime in 2024, 2025. I'm like, well, tell me about it then. Like, I'm not going to think about it. Between now and then, I can't afford to think about it.
So when I look at release dates, I obviously, as someone that reviews a lot of games, I'm always like, okay, so 2 weeks before then, I'm going to be starting to work on this. And then especially in this busy period coming up with like Jedi and Zelda and all that stuff, it's like, okay, I think I can fit in about one day of being a normal human being between like going between those. So when something's far off, I usually just think, I don't really care when this comes out. I'm more interested about what is coming out around it and how that's going to fuck me. Like with Spider-Man and Starfield, like how is that going to completely destroy my life for a week?
Yeah, I get to cherry pick a bit more what I cover and what I don't these days. Because at The Guardian, we have one game review a week. Like that's really one, maybe two.
You're not doing guides? Not doing 100 Zelda guides?
No, not yet. Wait until we get bought by someone who decides that's the new strategy. because we only really have room for... Also, like, we have... So I work 4 days a week, right? We have 4/5 of a games editor and a similarly partish time games correspondent, right? So I'm like, well, we're clearly never covering everything. Like, that's not happening. So what we get to choose, what does we want to cover? And so that does make it a bit difficult when things surprise launch then, because it's like, oh, well, there's I don't have any bandwidth. I can't be like, oh, here, you know, one of my 7 staff writers, just take this on. It was much easier at IGN or Kotaku, because obviously we had big staffs and you could always give something to someone and someone would always be happy to do it. But like now professionally it's very much like there's not much room in the in the publications. In my publication, there's not all that much room for games anyway, right? So, you really have to be selective about what you cover.
Yeah. Well, if you want more information on Immortals of Avium, when this podcast goes live, if everything goes to plan, there will be an interview on VGC and a preview. Also, I think the first trailer, the first proper trailer is going live when this goes live. I'm saying live a lot. Stop saying live.
You've
live.
Successfully got me interested in this game, although I still, even though you said it several times, I still can't remember the name of it. It's
Immortals of Avium.
No one's going to remember that.
Trust me.
That's a real problem.
While writing this interview and writing this preview, I had the exact same thing. I was like, first of all, how the fuck do you spell it? And secondly, can I just call it Immortals? Can I just start personally shorten it? Everyone will call it Immortals.
But then you got Immortals Phoenix Rising.
Phoenix Rising,
Any game with the word Immortal in it now is like, oh, no, that's been filed somewhere in a... It's been filed in the junk drawer of my brain with all the other Immortals games. I actually do think that's a real problem. Like, naming games now is hard because so many subtitles, so many thing that it
something
does become
unleashed.
Hard to Unbounded. Do you remember Unbounded?
That's why proper games have names like EAFC. Says what it does what it says in the tin.
Yeah.
A football game.
Yeah. There was an interesting conversation on Kinda Funny where they were like, The name EAFC, will enough people worldwide know that FC means football club? And I was just like, I feel so disconnected. I mean, obviously those guys are American and very lovely. Shout out Blessing for wearing his West Ham shirt yesterday. But I feel like FC, doesn't FC say football more than like FIFA does? Or has the FIFA brand like...
No, that's wild. Like, I'm sorry. Everybody in the world knows what FC means. Like, surely. Yeah. That's such... Oh, wow. I love those little cultural differences that come up with the Americans sometimes. So you're like,
To be fair to Blessing, who does watch football, he was saying to Timmy, he was like, no, it's football club. Like, people will get this, but I thought that was super interesting because obviously this is like... arguably the biggest rebrand of a gaming series ever from FIFA to EAFC. And they've kind of started... Where was
but
that?
They can't call it football, can they? Because of the international markets in which football doesn't mean football. Yeah.
Yeah, so it'll have to be EAFC.
And they can't call it soccer because that will piss off literally everyone else. So it's a difficult rebrand.
Yeah, I think they'll probably be fine. Chris sent me a picture from Parkhead at the weekend. They had a big billboard up. Where was that?
It was just outside Celtic Park. So as you come out the stadium, there's an enormous billboard. It just said EAFC, the logo with the Celtic colours behind it. I noticed I was really impressed by the organisation that EA did in kind of promoting this last week. Is like the amount of social media work behind the scenes that must have gone into this. Because if you go back and check, when they kind of announced last week, here's the new logo and blah, 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 something like 400 football clubs from around the world all at the exact same time posted the logo with their colours behind it, basically saying we're in. So they must have gone through every league and every team and said, by the way, can you do this in secret without it leaking? And it somehow they somehow pulled it off. So fair play to them. But yeah,
it's did all the Scottish teams do it, or was it just
Celtic and Rangers?
Celtic
and the Rangers yeah. company. But it's interesting. I'm curious to see what people start calling it, because obviously you call FIFA FIFA. Are they going to call it FC? Are they going to call it EA?
I bet people still call it FIFA for years. Like, I bet people say, are you going to get the new FIFA? They need to do, I reference this to Chris, the WWF to WWE Get the F Out campaign. They have to do that with FIFA. Yeah, like, half time during the Champions League, they have to come on and be like, fuck FIFA, we're EAFC, and make it clear. Like,
but, I look forward to Gianni Infantino's response to that. every time he's opened his mouth and talked about the video games, I'm like, oh, this is gold. I love it.
I love that quote he said when he's talking about the new FIFA game, whether it's FIFA 24, 25, 26, will be the best e-game for boys and girls.
The best e-game for every boy and girl. I was like, this is gold. Every time he talks, it's wonderful.
Well, before we wrap up the best e-podcast for boys and girls, I asked, because the Xbox, I was looking at Xbox 360 stuff because I'm deeply nostalgic and realized that it turns 18 this year. So I asked the e-boys and girls for some Xbox 360 memories. Very quickly, Christopher MacArthur Boyd, who will be joining us in the podcast in the not-too-distant future, said on Twitter, the initial shock of realizing my mum and dad had got me the arcade version of the 360 and didn't get me batteries for the Guitar Hero 3 controller, which was my only game, meaning the only thing I could play on my next-gen console was Pac-Man.
Wow.
That's brutal. I forgot they've released the arcade version of it, and it didn't have a hard drive, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it was like you got the arcade, and then was there like a 4 and a 20 gig? I know this sounds extremely alien that they would release a console with like 20 gigs of storage, but that's, when I read that, I was like, that is like a Christmas ruiner. Like, that's like the entire day is destroyed. Like, you just sit there feeling sick because you're like, I can't play with my thing. Alex Green, the XBLA Summer of Arcade, and I also miss Summer of Arcade, but you can never do it nowadays because there is a billion indie arcade, whatever we're calling these games with like smaller teams. But that had like Explosion Man, and I think Trials, the original Trials was a Summer of Arcade game.
Xbox Live Arcade is underrated, honestly. I think it did an awful lot. Everyone talks about how Sony and the PS4 were what made indie happen on console, but no bullshit. Oh, no. It was XBLA for sure.
Fucking Castle Crashers and Braid and all those kind of like
Limbo. Wasn't Limbo also one of those?
Limbo was one of the, because Summer of Arcade, it was like, okay, you're going to get 5 weeks of games. A couple of them will be bangers. I mean, a few of them will be like South Park, Scott Tenorman Must Die, one of the worst games I've ever paid money for. But
I should probably drop in my obligatory 1 vs 100 reference.
Oh yeah, bring it back. And Tyler Renard, first time I ever opened up a console was my 360 when it red-ringed, and I managed to resurrect it for a few months. Also, the console that introduced me to online multiplayer humbled me in exactly how bad I was at playing games. Just on the red ring, I only had one console red ring, and I told that story in this podcast, and then the Xbox I bought after that was confusingly the Final Fantasy 13 Xbox that had lightning on the front of it.
Oh, God,
because it was the only one I could get. So for like years following that, I was like fucking playing these like shooters and like Gears of War and all this shit, because I was like a fucking 14 and 15 year old boy, so I was obviously the absolute worst, like the smelliest wee grot bag ever. And then just lightning on the front of my 360 faceplate. Keza, what was, you were obviously in the midst of covering games in the 360 era, that was like, is it fair to say that was your ascent? A quick look at LinkedIn seems to say you started in 2006.
Yeah, the first console launch I ever covered was the Xbox 360 launch. I was 17. I went to the Xbox 360 launch party when I was 17 and got way too drunk and I had to be like escorted off the premises. Don't give 17-year-olds free booze. Like, never do that. Idiot.
Give fucking 27-year-olds free booze.
And right, I believe I was headbanging to No Music at one point on the dance floor. I think my editor may have had to be like, okay, I am going to go home. I think the thing is, because I was literally a junior staff writer, not even a staff writer, junior staff writer on the magazine, I got given the shittest 360 games, like the ones that like nobody would even touch. Like almost as a joke, I would be given the worst. So like a lot of my early 360 memories are of these absolutely dreadful games, like Tequila Overdose and like things like that. Really, really bad games. Some that were so broken. It might have been called Beatdown or something. There was like a Capcom game. I think it was Capcom that was unplayably. Didn't work. So like the early few months of the 360, I was given all the worst games to play and review. And then when I left that job, I basically took 3 weeks off and just sat in my pants and played Oblivion on the 360 for the whole time, for like weeks continuously. I just woke up at breakfast, played Oblivion all day, went to sleep and repeated. And it was such a like real, it's a real core gaming memory for me. I loved that time. It was great.
See, this is the thing that I really resent about people telling me that I hate Xbox, because without the Xbox 360, like, I am not doing this job. Because people of my age always say, like, oh, the PS2 and the GameCube have these, like, amazing memories of halcyon days with those consoles. And I had those consoles. I was playing them and also, like, going out to play with my mates and playing football and stuff like that. It was always the thing you did when you got home. It wasn't until I got the 360 that I properly started no life in games. And that was, like, I had, like, at one point I had like 70 or 75 360 games. I mean, this won't help my reputation when I tell you that I traded most of those games in to buy a PS3 in Infamous. You can fucking you can blame Greg Miller for that one and his propaganda in that era. The Xbox 360, that is like that is the games console for me. Like, debates about the best games console ever are so stupid because they're massively subjective.
It's high up there though, like the 360.
Yeah.
Like
the run from like 2006 to 2010, every year it was like there's fucking 10 bangers.
Also the
like,
console that housed Viva Pinata, let's not forget. Masterpiece that is Viva Pinata. Genuinely fucking love that game. Brilliant game.
Yeah. For me as well, and I know this isn't everyone doesn't feel the same way, but for me it changed the way I play games because it introduced achievements.
Yeah.
And I know people love achievements and people hate achievements, but for me it was like it changed everything because it gave me a reason to keep playing stuff. And the way my brain works, it's like I need some kind of way to tell me that a game is complete, which is why I don't like live service games that much, because you can never complete a live service game. It never ends. So for me, achievements were great because when you got that 1,000 gamer score or 200, when it was arcade games, which is too low, it was like, this game is complete now. Like it is inarguably finished. I can move on, and I used to love that. And like we used to cheat, me and Ryan King, who was on Official Xbox Magazine at the time when I was at Official Nintendo Magazine, we worked adjacent desks, and we shared a flat together. In the living room had two TVs with two Xbox 360 set up, and when new games would come out, then the press copies would turn up at the office. We'd each take a copy of something and take it home and play multiplayer against each other to get the multiplayer achievement.
Nice.
We'd spend a whole night grinding like Sega Superstars Tennis, so each of us got 100 wins online multiplayer on like the first night.
He was a big,
before anyone got
big
it.
Chivos guy. Remember
it
well.
Was. Me and him used to compete. It was brilliant.
I used to do all the fucking dark arts. Like you would flash your Fallout 3 save to a memory card, put it on the PC, unlock all the achievements, and then flash it back to your Xbox, and it would just go ding, 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 ding.
Corruption,
shocking crimes. Yet again, crimes.
Come and get me, Aaron Greenberg.
The other week we had some friends round, and I decided we were going to play Beatles Rock Band. We got all the plastic shit out, finally got everything working, got the 360, we started our first song, game froze, and I was like, oh, fucking thing. Turned it off, turned it back on, red ring.
Jeez.
My ninth
retro
Xbox 360 red ring in 2023. I was like, This is no one cares anymore. But for me,
you're on the phone with Microsoft, like, right, come on to fuck, send me the coffin.
Jay Allard from
the most tragic thing about my life now, and this is like, this depresses me more than I can ever explain, is that I can't play Guitar Hero anymore. I used to adore Guitar Hero and Rock Band, and that was my thing for the longest time. Like, played Dragon Force on Expert and all that. I was like properly into it. And a few years back, Serena was like one, I was doing the gardening, and with hedge trimmers cut right through my finger and severed a nerve in my finger. And they repaired it all up, but I've got no feeling in this, in my my ring finger on my left hand. And when I stretch my hand, I can feel it. It's painful, which means I can't play the frets anymore in Guitar Hero. So I've got my guitar sitting there behind me in the couch, and behind the couch, and it'll just never be played because that's like 4 years later, and it's still painful when I stretch my hand. I'll never be able to play it.
You just
again.
Need to learn how to do it maca style.
I should have insured my hands.
You have just made me think, like, shit, if I ever lose my fingers, that's a real problem for my career.
I think about that all the time. Like, I was playing Five Asides, like, 6 months ago, and a guy trod on my hand, and this was the night before the Pokemon World Championships, and I was like, if I can't go down to the Pokemon World Championships because my finger is hanging off, I'll be deeply disappointed. And it was one of those where, like, you don't look at it, and you feel it, and you're like, it feels like they're all there, and then it was fine.
Well, you'll be sick by now, Jordan, to hear me moaning about my wrists and that. My hands are just gone. Like,
it's like Bart Simpson with a cement mixer.
Because I do work and then go straight to writing books every night.
That's unwise, mate.
My wrists are they're just gone now at this point. So
just use AI, anyway. Mate. If you was like,
just in case it wasn't clear enough how old we are.
The Chris Scullion is Falling Apart podcast.
Yeah, every single week. If you'd like to write into the Chris Scullion is Falling Apart podcast, you can do so at podcast@videogamechronicle.com. Keza, where can people find you?
I'm video games editor at The Guardian, so you can find me there. I do a newsletter called Pushing Buttons, which comes out every Wednesday. Please go subscribe to that. I'm very proud of it. And you can find me on Twitter at Keza McDonald, where I'm almost never there anymore because of Elon Musk. But nonetheless, there I am.
Excellent. Keza, thank you very much for coming on. You were the first voice of a Scottish games journalist I ever heard.
On the IGN podcast.
IGN UCAPAS. Yeah. Yep.
Excellent.
I was absolutely obsessed with that program back in the day. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for not, like, leaving the games industry, because I feel like most of my heroes from that era have fully fucked off at this point.
It's not very well paid or well respected. So, like, unsurprisingly, people don't stick around too long. Thank you for not being one of the IGN UK podcast listeners who used to write in asking what the teenage boy was doing on the podcast.
me and my mates all used to listen to it, and we were extremely protective of you because you were Scottish. We were like, there's one down there in the big fucking smoke. If we're going to be game journalists, we need to fucking get in with
her. Yeah, the Scottish video game mafia obviously has continued to grow since. You love to see it.
Look at us now, half of VGC. Video Games Caledonia. You can follow us on Twitter, me at Jordan Midler, Chris at Scully 1888, and Keza at Keza McDonald. We'd like to thank the great Grant Kirkhope for the VGC podcast theme. Say goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, Chris.
Say goodbye, Keza.
Bye, Keza.
And we'll see you next week.
VGC, a video games podcast, is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, and join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.